The Life of Lucius Annaeus Seneca, Podcast 5, Seneca and Caligula. Welcome back to this podcast series on the life of Lucius Annaeus Seneca. When we last left Seneca, he was a member of the Senate and beginning to attract attention for his skill in oratory and rhetoric. The year was AD 37, a year that was to go down on record as that in which one of history's monsters rose to become the most powerful man in the ancient world. Gaius Caesar, better known to history by his nickname Caligula, would become Emperor of Rome. If we recall from previous podcasts, Caligula's mother, Agrippina the Elder, and his two elder brothers, Drusus and Nero, were dead by AD 37. All of them victims of state persecution. Caligula was the last surviving male offspring of the popular and revered Germanicus. His three sisters, Drusilla, Agrippina the Younger, and Julia Livilla had also survived. And if we recall, Seneca seems to have allied himself politically with the last two. Before discussing Caligula and his reign in any detail, it's important to understand that we today see him through the lens of ancient historians, many of whom had their own axe to grind. It's also important to understand that Caligula had nothing to gain by persecuting the common people. On the contrary, he lavished them with spectacles. They probably loved him. All historians and writers in other genres of Caligula's time, and for a considerable time afterwards, were educated men of the upper orders of Roman society. Well, when you think about it, who else could write? And it was these men, his nearest peers, whom Caligula had it in for. So it's no wonder that his name passed immediately upon his death into the roll call of Roman monsters and villains. The process can be seen clearly in Seneca's corpus. Seneca didn't dare write a bad word against Caligula while that madman was still alive, and understandably so. But he didn't hesitate to slag him off, often and with extreme prejudice, as soon as Caligula had been safely assassinated. But even taking the blackwashing of Caligula's character into account, and despite some attempts by modern-day historian apologists, there can be very little doubt that, to the ruling classes of Rome anyway, Caligula was a very dangerous and very nasty piece of work. In around AD 30, Caligula, at age 18 or 19, had been summoned to attend the reclusive Tiberius on the island of Capri, where he was eventually marked out as the emperor's successor. Before he could accede to the throne, though, he had to run the gauntlet of courtly intrigues and infighting. But that was no problem for Caligula, as the boy appears to have been born crafty. He was a natural actor. Either that, or he'd learned fast during his mother's headbutting with the odious and overly ambitious Sejanus, Tiberius's erstwhile praetorian commander, who was eventually executed in AD 31. Caligula neatly sidestepped all attempts by Tiberius's toadies to get the young man to openly criticize the emperor, even when orders sanctioned by the state went out to have Caligula's two brothers murdered. And as for Tiberius, well, he seems to have fully understood the sneaky and unscrupulous snake he was rearing in the bosom of his household. Knowing of the younger man's excitement at watching executions and tortures, and being seemingly more amused than anything else at Caligula's forays into nighttime dens of drunken lechery disguised in a wig and long cloak, Tiberius is reported to have said, "I am nursing a viper for the Roman people and a Phaeton for the whole world." Phaeton, of course, was the mortal son of Apollo, who had begged his father to have a ride on the sun chariot, even though he was totally incapable of handling it, with disastrous consequences. I guess what Tiberius was getting at here was that the reins of state would be eventually handed over to a thoroughly unsuitable candidate whose inexperience and rashness would end up trashing the balance of the whole Roman machine. Given all this, it could hardly have surprised Tiberius when, on the 16th of March AD 37, Caligula entered the old emperor's bedchamber and either smothered him with a pillow or throttled him with his own hands. At least that was the word on the street. And it was difficult to refute, as the only witness to the murder was one of Tiberius's old retainers, whom Caligula promptly had put to death. And it was also said that in the years to follow, Caligula would often brag about his murderous deed. So Tiberius was dead, and his adopted heir Caligula, or Gaius Caesar to give him his correct name, took his place. The early days were full of hope. We have to remember that Caligula was the son of the revered Germanicus. He restored the honour of his discredited immediate family in suitably ostentatious and dramatic fashion. He had the names of his three surviving sisters, Drusilla, Julia Livilla, and Agrippina the Younger, included in all official oaths. He even invited his uncle, the future Emperor Claudius, to be his co-consul. The people loved Caligula. He undid the perceived injustices of the reign of his predecessor. He recalled all exiles, annulled any outstanding criminal charges, and he even publicly burned any evidence that could incriminate those who had played a part in his mother's and brother's deaths. Caligula also reversed the public book burnings of Tiberius's reign by ordering the condemned author's works to be republished. Among these works was some by the historian Cremutius Cordus, and that's important for us, as Seneca's earliest known prose work, The Consolation to Marcia, Marcia being Cremutius Cordus's daughter, was centred on the recirculation of those books. I'll concentrate on The Consolation to Marcia, or the Consolatio ad Marciam, in the next podcast, but for now, the reign of Caligula is important, as it is the first time that Seneca has achieved a high enough profile to have been noticed on the public record, albeit in an anecdotal fashion by a commentator writing a good generation or two later. In a previous podcast, I mentioned that Seneca seemed to have allied himself somehow with two of Caligula's sisters, Julia Livilla and Agrippina the Younger. I suspect that the elevation of their profiles under their brother, the new emperor, also raised the profile of Seneca himself by association. But it was a dangerous association, because Caligula was a vain and unpredictable creature, and his relationship with his sisters, especially with Drusilla, bordered on the unhealthy. But the first year and a bit of Caligula's reign was a bit like a honeymoon. He lavished the people with games and spectacles, undertook public building works, toured Greece and Gaul and other places where he held equally spectacular shows, as well as organized competitions in Greek and Latin oratory. One of his grandest and most ostentatious demonstrations was to have a bridge of boats built for 3.5 miles across the Gulf of Naples from Baiae to Puteoli, so that he could ride across it on a horse. All of this was costing the state treasury big time, and the bridge of boats episode is something that Seneca would often point back to as pure folly. But Caligula's personality issues gradually set in. He began to see himself more as a god than an emperor, even to the extent that he declared Jupiter had invited the emperor to share his home up on the Capitoline Hill. Seneca must have started to ask himself if these foibles of Caligula were the result of an overly dramatic bent or the first signs of a delusional power complex. But then the political murders started, and there could no longer be any doubt. Caligula was accused by later writers of committing incest with his sisters. But we've got to be a bit careful here, as much that was written about him was done so after his death, and all of that was designed to deliberately blacken his name. There is, in my mind anyway, very little doubt that Caligula had some form of mental instability, possibly even an illness. I'd also say that he had a serious obsession with his sisters, Drusilla especially. But whether that stretched to actual incest, well, that's anybody's guess. Caligula certainly loved his sisters, even to the extent of taking Drusilla from her husband and cavorting around Rome with her as if she were his queen. And when Drusilla died, just a year or so into his reign, Caligula was devastated, and he staged a massively dramatic display of grief. He rushed from Rome, went on a voyage, and then returned just as impetuously, appearing back in the city, unshaven and shaggy-haired. And as for his dealings with the Senate, where we remember Seneca had been a member for some years, after a respectful start, the cracks started to appear. Caligula made some senior members of that august body run for miles beside his chariot, dressed in their full togas, or else he made them wait on him at banquets in disrespectfully short linen tunics. He would have those he disliked killed in secret, and then send for them publicly, declaring when they failed to turn up that they must have committed suicide. He'd even torment his supposed peers at the games by scattering gift vouchers among the rows reserved for the higher echelons of Roman society before anybody was seated, in order to encourage the mob to stampede into the reserved areas of the stadium. Some of the senatorial class were singled out for especial torture. Some were branded, others sent to the mines. The less fortunate were locked in tiny cages and kept like animals, or sawn, yes, sawn in half. Parents were forced to attend their sons' executions. Caligula even made sure one extremely sick father attended his son's death by sending a litter to bring him to the killing place. The catalogue of Caligula's atrocities just goes on and on and on. And he didn't seem to give a damn because, like other supposedly bloodthirsty Romans, Caligula is also attributed with frequently quoting the line from Accius's play Atreus, "Oderint dum metuant," he'd declare, "Let them hate me so long as they fear me." I said earlier that we have to be careful about how later historians portrayed Caligula, but Seneca lived through everything I'm describing here. He actually witnessed it at first hand. He knew Caligula. He knew Caligula's sisters. And although they may conceivably have afforded him some protection for a while, Seneca, along with his senatorial peers, must have spent 4 years treading on eggshells around such a volatile and vindictive personality as Caligula's. What was written after his death about Caligula may have been exaggerated somewhat, but let's listen to some of the things Seneca wrote about him, admittedly safely after the madman's assassination, and then make up our minds. Talking of Caligula's behaviour after the death of Drusilla, and remembering that Seneca uses Caligula's real name, Gaius, he writes, "I cannot pass by the emperor whose name ought to be torn from every last list of the Caesars, the one whom nature produced to be the ruin and shame of the human race, who utterly wasted and wrecked the empire that is only now being restored." He tried to relieve his distress at Drusilla's deeply regretted death with dice and gaming board and other common engrossments of the sort. What a disgrace to the empire! He would inflict the most cruel punishments upon those who had not shown sufficient sorrow. In reference to some of Caligula's other faults, Seneca writes, "Gaius Caesar, who amid the multitude of his other vices had a bent for insult, was moved by the strange desire to brand everyone with some stigma." Seneca then goes on to describe what an ugly specimen Caligula was, with his ugly and pale face, his eyes beneath the brow of an old hag, his balding head with straggly hairs, his neck overgrown with bristles, his spindly legs and enormous feet. And then Seneca continues with the recollection of an incident at a banquet as follows. Among Caligula's closest friends was one Asiaticus Valerius, a man of proud spirit who was not likely to take an insult lying down. At a banquet, Gaius loudly complained that Valerius's wife was no good in bed. By the gods! What a disgrace that A, the emperor should even know this, and B, that he should admit to his adultery in public, and admit it to the ears of the husband concerned to boot, and that man a consul and supposed friend. There are many other references by Seneca that are just as damning. The stories of regular murders and executions of senators, even consuls, for Caligula's amusement, the torturing of many others by every means, by fire, on the rack, by a cord. Seneca even records that at one stage, Caligula considered murdering the entire Senate. And he recalls the emperor's statement that they wished the Roman people only had one neck, presumably so that he could execute the lot of them with just one blow. Seneca doesn't skimp on graphic detail when condemning the manic excesses of Caligula, and we have to remember that not only was he eyewitness to a lot of what was going on, but he was writing about it in the two decades following Caligula's assassination. So I guess the answer to the question about how much history has blackened Caligula's name is pretty obvious. Not much, if at all. Well, at least if you were among those who had the most to fear. That is, if you were one of the Roman elite classes, of which Seneca could count himself a member. So after a promising start, the monster inside Caligula started to emerge. He does appear to have suffered a major illness in the earlier part of his reign, which has led some commentators to speculate that his accelerating sociopathic tendencies were driven by something like syphilis. And yes, that might well have been a contributory factor, but to me the evidence suggests that Caligula was a very flawed human being indeed, and from an early age. Whether he was born disturbed, it was something that grew over time as his personal survival instincts kicked in over a perilous period during his youth and teens, we'll never know. But he was vicious, overly dramatic, sneaky, egotistical, and narcissistic. He was all those things and more. Seneca himself had a very narrow escape from Caligula's caprices. All during this period, he was a senator with a growing reputation, a debater and orator with a distinctive, punchy style. As I mentioned earlier, he may have enjoyed the favour of Caligula's sisters, but that would not save him from attracting unwanted attention from an increasingly unstable emperor. Although Caligula was more inclined to drama than letters, he is credited with being an accomplished student of rhetoric and a quick-witted speaker, especially when he was prosecuting some unfortunate target. Apparently, he'd often start a speech by boasting that he was about to draw the sword which he had forged in his midnight study. His learning, though, didn't give rise to a commensurate appreciation for the accomplishment of others, and it was obvious that he was envious of the growing accolades that Seneca's polished and elegant style was attracting. Caligula belittled Seneca's efforts as commissiones meras, that is, mere textbook exercises, and his speeches and oratory as harena sine calce, or sand without lime, inferring by that they were just a string of utterances held together by no bonding logic. Pure show, in other words. And Caligula wouldn't be the last to take an instant dislike to how Seneca wrote. Many centuries later, in the 1800s, Lord Macaulay penned these words: "I cannot bear him. His style affects me in something the same way with that of Gibbon." But Lucius Seneca's affectation is even more rank than Gibbon's. His works are made up of mottos. There is hardly a sentence which might not be quoted, but to read him straightforward is like dining on nothing but anchovy sauce. Caligula's scorn and aversion to Seneca's style was enough that he wanted him dead. But there happened to be a woman present, unnamed by the chronicler of the event, who saved Seneca's skin by pointing out that Seneca's long-standing and recurrent pulmonary condition, which we talked about in a previous podcast, was going to do him in the short term anyway. Now, with historical hindsight, I very much want to believe that the anonymous woman who saved Seneca's bacon at that perilous time was none other than one of Caligula's sisters, either Julia Livilla or Agrippina the Younger. It's impossible to tell now who she was, but later events would demonstrate a definite link between Seneca and the two sisters. Caligula's full litany of bad behaviour is too extensive to list in this podcast, but if you're interested, it is chronicled in detail in Suetonius's chapter on that emperor in his book The Twelve Caesars. But just a word of warning if you are going to read that. Suetonius does like to be a bit sensationalist and gossipy, and not everything can be taken at face value, although it does make for a damn good read. As far as Seneca is concerned, we only really have to look at one or two more episodes of Caligula's short reign, and then only briefly, as they concern other members of Caligula's immediate family and Seneca's involvement in them. Although currently unprovable, they may have had a huge bearing on what was to happen in the following decade. By AD 39, the increasingly barking Caligula was being faced with a growing number of conspiracies to overthrow him. By far the most important of these for us was the attempt in that year to replace the emperor with his brother-in-law, Marcus Aemilius Lepidus. Lepidus had been married to Caligula's favourite sister, the now deceased Drusilla, and was also, if the rumours are to be believed, the lover of both surviving sisters, Agrippina the Younger and Julia Livilla. It's highly likely that Agrippina was the brains behind the conspiracy, although for my part, I suspect that dear old Uncle Claudius may have had a hand in there somewhere. Seneca would, later in his career, receive extreme favours from Agrippina for unspecified support. And that was possibly related to this episode. Anyway, whatever the mechanics of the conspiracy, it failed. Lepidus was executed, and both Julia and Agrippina were exiled to the Pontine Islands in the Mediterranean Sea, off the coast of the Italian peninsula. There would be no return from that exile until after the death of their brother in AD 41. It was time for Seneca to keep his head down. Caligula was no fan of his literary style, and the members of the Julio-Claudian family to which he had allied himself were in exile. To make this an even more difficult time for him, around AD 39, Seneca's father, known to history as Seneca the Elder, a man loved and respected by his three sons, passed away. Seneca would later write a book, De Vita Patris, or On the Life of My Father, which sadly has not survived the ages, and that's a massive pity because it would have filled in so many of the gaps in what we know of Seneca's own life. Caligula himself didn't last much longer. His sociopathic tendencies grew, and he became increasingly erratic. In AD 40, the emperor made a pathetic, it was even laughable, attempt at invading Germany and Britain, and he began to become the object of ridicule. Caligula's constant persecution of the ruling classes eventually bred a successful attempt on his life, which was led by Cassius Chaerea, an officer of the Praetorian Guard, and a man whom Caligula had constantly baited by tating his masculinity. But that can't have been the only driver. My own suspicion is that bumbling old Uncle Claudius was pulling all the strings behind the scenes here, and his and Seneca's shared love of literature and study suggests to me that their paths would have crossed on more than one or two occasions. Certainly, the future interaction between the two, and certain things that Seneca later wrote about the relationship between himself and Claudius, have set my alarm bells ringing. But those episodes are for podcasts yet to come. So we'll leave Seneca for now. It's January AD 41, and Caligula has been cut down in the corridors underneath the palace on the Palatine. Seneca has had to keep his head down for a while. He's learned a very valuable lesson since his close shave with Caligula and the condemnation of his oratorical and writing style. He's learned to be cautious in everything he says and everything he writes. But if Seneca actually thinks that, with the assassination of Caligula, things are going to get better for himself personally, well, he'd better start thinking again. So please join me again for my next podcast on the life of Lucius Annaeus Seneca.